You might well ask why we have decided to talk about this subject tonight. Well, as we've just seen, Cyprus is very much in the news, and for reasons I'll explain, I think will be more than ever in future. So it's an area that's in that very sensitive part of the world, in the eastern Mediterranean. Anything that goes on there, I think, warrants our attention. Secondly, I'm aware that many brothers and sisters often go to Cyprus for their holidays, and when you talk to them and they come back and say, well, what did you think about this and that, they look at you with total amazement, not realising, of course, the vital part that Cyprus plays and will yet play in those events in the Middle East. I might also say that, of course, it's called Aphrodite's Island. And only this week, I think Thursday, I got a leaflet from a travel agent saying, hey, why don't you come with us for a holiday on the islands of Aphrodite and St. Paul, or in English, that is Cyprus and Malta. So it's a title that is used because, as you know, don't you, Aphrodite was the daughter of the mythological Zeus and alleged to be the most beautiful woman that's ever lived on earth, and therefore it follows that her island, where she was born in Cyprus, is a very beautiful island, which of course it is. I've often thought, and when I get time I might get round to it, to look at the, if you like, the background effect of Greek mythology on some of the things we read in the scriptures. Aphrodite was a daughter, in mythological terms, of Zeus. Zeus it was who disguised himself as a bull and seduced Europa, daughter of the king of Tyre, and she became the figure that John used in Revelation 17 of the woman riding the beast. And of course, I might just tell you that following a meeting I went to with Ian Paisley, I'll say that again quietly, he gave a masterly, very interesting anyway, exposition of that, and as a result I wrote to our local member of the European Parliament. And I said, tell me, is there any evidence of Europa, this princess, riding upon the back of Jupiter, because that's the Roman equivalent of Zeus. The letter I got back, absolutely fascinating. Yes, said our local member of the European Parliament, it's there in the office of the President of the European Parliament in Brussels in the new building. There upon the wall of the European Parliament, brothers and sisters, is the very sign that John in Patmos used to portray Rome, papal Europe in the last days. Amazing, isn't it, when you get that confession coming from none other than your local member of the European Parliament. A lot more about Zeus. I mean, his Aphrodite's brothers, she had twin brothers, Castor and Pollux, and of course Apollo. Apollo presided over Delphi, and you know who came from Delphi? Why, was it rather irritating woman at Philippi that Paul had to contend with, and she was a priestess of Python. Where did she learn her trade? Right back there in Delphi. There's a lot more. Paul, of course, is aware of Zeus, because he quotes, doesn't he, that poem in Acts 17. The poem from Epimenides, and actually it's in Acts 17, but it has to do with Titus. Because when Titus is sent by Paul to Crete, you remember how the Cretans are described as slow bellies and liars? What were they lying about, brothers and sisters? Well, somebody had actually written a poem which said, we found the tomb of Zeus. Well, you can't say that. Everybody knows that Zeus is eternal, immortal, and therefore the people of Crete were called liars on that account. And Paul, oddly enough, quotes from that in Acts 17 in Corinth. So we ought to begin to look at Crete and Cyprus together in the same breath, as we shall end up doing. All right then, but there's another reason, and that is, there is a prophecy concerning Cyprus, I believe, that has been, to put it mildly, enigmatic to me, and I have never really seen an explanation of it. I'm aware that when you read certain leaflets about Numbers and Balaam's prophecy, which we'll come to, brethren sometimes skip over those verses. They are difficult to understand, so this is not a golden oldie tonight, but a problem that I've had to wrestle with, and well, you may or may not think I've come up with the right solution. All right, Turkey warns the European Union over danger of Cyprus war, but then it would, wouldn't it? Relations frozen as Europe says no to Turkey again. No, says Christian papal Europe. We do not want Islam in Europe. We'll have Greece, that's Eastern Orthodox, or
really Roman Catholicism under a different name. We'll have Greece, and we'll have southern parts of the Republic of Cyprus, but we will not have any more Islam in Europe. And so Turkey turns on its neighbour, Greece, and squabbles with Greece over all sorts of things, not the least, of course, being the oil, which is in the Aegean Sea. They threaten to annex, formally, North Cyprus. You know, you cannot fly to North Cyprus because it's not recognised internationally as an independent state. So no IATA airline will fly direct to northern Cyprus. You have to change planes in Istanbul. So there's this row going on about Cyprus, provoked by Islamic Turkey against Christian, falsely so-called, Cyprus. Well, what does the Bible tell us about Cyprus? You might well wonder, why can we talk about this for a whole session when there are only two references to Kittim? They were the sons of Javan, the people whose descendants are called Chittim. So you see two words in the Old Testament: Kittim, the place; Chittim, the people. And not more than half a dozen, or at most a dozen, references to them. They are people of Cyprus, Young's Concordance. I've taken a copy from Young's Concordance. People of Cyprus. And it says here, Chittim is often noticed in Scripture. Well, I wouldn't call that number of references often, but very significant where it does occur. Balaam predicted that a fleet should thence proceed for the destruction of Assyria. Seems a bit odd, that. And then we go on. But what I want to do is approach this subject from a long way back. Rather than just wrestle with a couple of verses, which we'll come to in the end, I think we've got to start back and remind ourselves of our old friend Nebuchadnezzar's image, and we will remember, as we saw in the first talk, how the empire split in two. Down this side, of course, is the bit we use in public, Daniel chapter 2, and then down the other side, the bit we don't use in public, not because we're slow to identify the Lion of Babylon or the bear with Russia, with Medo-Persia, leopard with Greece, but because we don't like the end of the story, which is the fourth beast, which is alive and well and living in Rome. So, whatever reasons, we rarely, am I correct, rarely deal with Daniel 7 in public. But there was the divided Roman Empire. Remember what we said? There were the two legs of the Roman Empire, which the Saracens and the Ottomans between them replaced as the power dominating the Middle East at the time of the Ottoman Empire. Now, you can tell these talks we have tended to give separately in the past, so there's a little bit of repetition. But that was the situation then when the truth was preached in this country. Brother Bernard Berth has just told me about, he thinks the truth was first preached in Northampton by a brother returning from the first Christadelphian conference in Birmingham in 1872. And apparently it's in the intelligence reports for the magazine for that year. But as I mentioned to you, the Russian power has always wanted to do no more. The Tsars have wanted to get back and once again become Caesars. And you've seen little anecdotal evidences of that, of course, in tourist terms. And anyone caring to look through a cheap paperback of Russian history will learn how continuously, from the time of Catherine the Great, they have kept nagging away. She tried to get into the Ukraine and get back towards Turkey. It's a little known fact, of course, that Russia does have a treaty, the Treaty of 1774, whereby it is guaranteed the right to look after the holy places in Jerusalem, a guardian of the holy places. And there's an interesting reason for that. When Constantine came back from York, you remember he was on duty there as sergeant, and they came back to Istanbul, took over the Caesarship of the eastern part of the Roman Empire. Very fond of his mum, so he says to Empress Helena, who's commemorated unto this day in St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, Saint Helena, sends her down to Jerusalem and then onwards to Sinai. And it's thanks to Empress Helena that we have the titles of Horeb and Sinai. And also, it was she who developed the idea that the Kidron Valley was in fact the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and that Christ ascended to heaven from the Mount of Olives, which he most certainly did not do, but that's a different subject. But the connections between the Russian Church and Israel are enormous, and I read in the journal, the Journal of the Russian Orthodox Church, which the man who publishes it lives not far from where we are, which is why I get it. And he said that the Russian Orthodox Church is, after the Israel Land Agency, the biggest landowner in Israel. Interesting point. But anyway, that's got away from our story. It was in the Crimean War, wasn't it, that the Russians attempted to come down into the Middle East. And Britain was very anxious to keep Russia out of the Middle East. It had very good reasons for doing so. It wanted to protect its investment in the Middle East, in the empire, in India, and eventually, of course, its interest, which developed later, in the Suez Canal. And so Britain and France, unlikely combination today, got together to stop Russia coming down into the Middle East. The Sultan was delighted with the help he got from Britain. Incidentally, until they changed the design on the £10 note, you might well have taken one out and said, whose image and superscription is that on the back of it? Why, it's Florence Nightingale. Florence Nightingale, the English £10 note, what's that got to do with Bible prophecy? Where did she set up the military hospital? It was in Scutari, opposite Istanbul. A reminder, brothers and sisters, as you put your money down on the Tesco counter, of the fulfilment of Bible prophecy. Remarkable. Everyday things that you can see remind us of Britain's role in keeping Russia out of the Middle East. Well, now the Sultan was delighted. A little while ago I came across the biography of Disraeli, quite an interesting book, and it has and tells the story of how Disraeli was sent by Queen Victoria to the Congress of Berlin in 1882. And in the Congress of Berlin in 1882, the Sultan was so delighted with the help he received from Britain, keeping Russia away from the Turkish Empire, that we were awarded Cyprus. And the story is quite dramatic. Disraeli returned from Berlin with Cyprus in his pocket, and Queen Victoria was not only amused, she was absolutely delighted, and he becomes Earl Beaconsfield. Reminder of a Conservative Prime Minister acting out that role assigned to Britain in prophecy. Cyprus was given to Britain by the Sultan of Turkey for services rendered. Vital to Britain to get it for its eventual protection of Suez and the Empire. 1915, of course, it was one of the strategic bases for the Gallipoli campaign, led by Churchill, very useful to Allenby and to Lawrence in their campaign subsequently to liberate Palestine. 1947, it was a useful place for Britain to dump Jewish refugees before the State of Israel. I'm sure you've seen those videos which show the pictures of that boat called Exodus. You know it. All those Jews crowded onto that boat, comes to Haifa, and the Brits say, no, get out. Go someplace else, like Cyprus. So, again, Britain fulfilling its protectorate role of Israel, of the Jews, finds Cyprus useful, because we've been there. But in the 1960s and 70s came the independence struggle of Brits out. Not our subject, but Britain said, OK, we'll pass an Act of Parliament, the Cyprus Act in 1960, and we'll go out. But if you don't mind, we will retain as sovereign territory two bases, Akrotiri and Decalia. Now, the point about sovereign territory is that Decalia and Akrotiri are as British as Northampton. They are sovereign territory of Britain. They're not just leased bases, like the Americans lease Air Force bases in East Anglia or anything like that. They're sovereign territory of Britain. In 1991, of course, they were very useful as a strategic base during the Gulf War. Very useful for Britain's role in the Middle East. And in the late 1990s, as we've seen, as a listening post for developments in the Middle East. So that's Russia, that's Cyprus, and how Britain came to be there. I'm indebted to Brother John Beryl, who sent me a copy earlier this week. He can't have known I was going to mention this, where he refers to a book by Brother Frank Janaway on Palestine and the powers. It tells the story exactly of how Disraeli came by a British presence in Cyprus. And it was because Britain was appointed by the Lord, I believe, in times gone by to keep Russia out. Time has not come for Ezekiel 38. But in 1974, because of the squabbling between Greece and Turkey, between Christianity and Islam, Turkey decided to invade. And so I can remember it well happening, actually, although it's 74, knocking on 30 years, 25 years ago. I can remember the kerfuffle that was created when Turkey invaded North Cyprus. And so at the end of that little campaign, Turkey occupied the northern part of Cyprus, and Greece, or Cyprus, the independent republic of Cyprus, occupied the southern half. Incidentally, if you come out of Larnaca Airport, you turn left, and third on the right is Kitty. Kitten. You can see the signs, Kittio. Donald Pierce was there and sent me a photograph of the ancient sites, a reminder of the Young's Concordance. Well, all right, that's where we are today. Now we've got to turn back and take a long view at this subject and remind ourselves of Daniel chapter 8. We've looked at Daniel chapter 2. We know the story, don't we, of how Daniel chapter 8 depicts the struggle between Greece and Persia. Time doesn't permit us to deviate, as we find it fascinatingly interesting too, to point out that when Daniel gave that prophecy of chapter 8, the ram and the he-goat, he was using terms which could easily have been identified to his hearers then. For what is the Greek word for a goat? Why, it's an Aegean. Aegean Sea. Aegea was the capital of the empire in Alexander's time. And if you read Newton's dissertation on the prophecies, you will know that what he locates as a word for Persia or a ram is in fact the Persian or the Elamitic word for a ram. So people then knew that there was going to come this battle, as a result of which, of course, Greece takes over from Persia. Well, the Greek Empire was led by a power called Alexander the Great. And those are my young friends who are doing history, will want to know that's Alexander the Great. And the Bible talks about Alexander the Great in those terms. And when Alexander the Great passed off the scene at a fairly early age, he was succeeded by four of his generals. And I'm again indebted to Jeff and Ray Walker for a little map which illustrates this. The four generals, and we needn't worry about two of them. General Seleucus took over this northern part. General Ptolemy took over the southern part. And there were two other generals, Lysimachus and Cassander, who took over Greece and the Balkans. Now, the Bible's not interested in all the nations of the earth. So, as it were, the prophet, through the Spirit word, says, look, forget about them. The story that I want you to follow, says Daniel, doesn't have to do with the Greek mainland and the Balkans. In fact, what he wants us to focus our attention on is the competitive struggle between General Seleucus and General Ptolemy. And when you draw out the sort of land that those two powers occupy, you will observe that the power in the north, the Seleucid power, occupied, yes, the area around Turkey and Iran and Assyria over here, but the power in the south, which was Egypt, included Cyprus. Now, if you go to the British Museum, you go to the Cyprus Gallery, they will show you and confirm how Cyprus, although it's tucked right up there under Turkey, was in fact part of the Ptolemaic Empire. You may say, well, that's an exquisitely interesting little detail, but what's it got to do with us? We'll see. Cyprus was, from Daniel's day onwards, the prophecies of Daniel 8 rather, part of the power of the south. So we've been to Daniel 2, we've been to Daniel 8, now let's turn over to Daniel chapter 11, and we would see, if you want to just take a look at Daniel chapter 11, you'll see for yourself, and I marked it on here, how it's really a continuous struggle between powers of the north, the power of Seleucus, and the powers of the south. And if you cast your eye down Daniel chapter 11, look at verse 5. I haven't got time to go all the way through this very long chapter, but it's unfolding a continuous struggle between verse 5, the king of the south will be strong. We come down to verse 8, certain things shall continue more years than the king of the north. Verse 11, the king of the south shall be moved with anger. And so, verse 15, the king of the north shall come. it's a ding-dong battle between the North and the South, and that, again, you can simply go to the British Museum, go to the Cyprus Room, as it used to be, and you'll see this for yourself. And all the way down this chapter, you come to verse 25, the King of the South is at it again, until you come over this long period of time towards the end of that chapter. And when you do, you come to verse 41, or verse 40, and you will see they're still at it. King of the North shall come against him, whoever him is, with chariots and with horsemen. And then verse 41, the King of the North shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries will be overthrown, and it spells them out. He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, and Libya, the Ethiopians, shall be in alliance. So the end of Daniel chapter 11 ends up the story. It brings it right from the time of the Greeks and the Persians right up to our own days. In fact, I am one of those who sees in Daniel chapter 11, in the end, a typical presentation of Armageddon, which would look, in the maps that Christadelphians have used, something like that. Now that illustration is, I know for a certain fact, over 50 years old, because I know where I've got it from, and it simply shows how the power out of the north in the last days will come down to Istanbul, like we said. And then onwards down to Egypt, and then Persia, or Iran, will be with that power, and they will come against Israel. And we said, what stood in the way of the power out of the north and its ambitions down here? Why Turkey? But then you notice something. We're not for one moment disputing that that's a pretty good way of doing a Peter Snow. You know Peter Snow on Newsnight, how he has all those complicated maps of how the Americans went that way and the British go that way and the Iraqis come this way. Well, this is really just a Christadelphian way of showing what would happen at the time of Armageddon. But you notice, Turkey is right in the way. And beneath Turkey is Cyprus. But Cyprus is not Turkey. Historically, in the early part of Daniel chapter 11, it was part of the power out of the north. Well now, so far in few 15 minutes or so, we've drawn on very quickly Daniel 2, 7, 8, 11. We've had a look at the effects of the trumpets, Revelation 8, 9, and the vials, Revelation 16, Ezekiel 38, the descent of the power of the north. Now I want you to turn to Numbers 24. Numbers 24, which Ken is going to read a section for us, is, for our purposes tonight, I've called Balaam's prophetic parable. It's a prophetic parable, or it's a prophecy in parable form. So let us read Numbers 24, 15 to 25.
So reading from Numbers chapter 24, commencing at the 15th verse. And he took up his parable and said, Balaam the son of Beor hath said, and the man whose eyes are open hath said, he hath said, which heard the words of God, and knew the knowledge of the Most High, which saw the vision of the Almighty falling into a trance, but having his eyes open. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth. And Edom shall be a possession. Sias also shall be a possession for his enemies. And Israel shall do valiantly. Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that remaineth of the city. And when he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he perish for ever. And he looked on the Kenites and took up his parable and said, Strong is thy dwelling place, and thou puttest thy nest in a rock. Nevertheless the Kenites shall be wasted, until Ashur shall carry thee away captive. And he took up his parable and said, Alas, who shall live when God doeth this? And ships shall come from the coast of Chittim, and shall afflict Ashur, and shall afflict Eber, and he also shall perish for ever. And Balaam rose up and went and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way.
Now, generally speaking, there's no big problem with the references there as we see them to the time when Christ shall come and will deal with the nations round about. But I want to emphasise one thing. This is that the chapter is a prophetic parable. Verse 14, Behold, I go unto my people. Come therefore, and I will advertise, I will tell you what this people will do to thy people in the latter days. There you are, quite explicitly, it's about the latter days. And secondly, it is described, verse 15, as a parable. Now we read on into verse 17, There shall come the star out of Jacob, a scepter shall arise out of Israel, shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth, and Edom shall be a possession, Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies, and Israel shall do valiantly. One thing before we get any further, who on earth are the children of Sheth? Now, certain modern translations have made an almighty blunder there, because they've translated it, like I know the Good News Bible does, as the children of Seth. That doesn't make any sense. So we have to look up who is in mind when this star of Jacob, obviously Christ, we don't need to discuss that, will destroy the children of Sheth. Well, now, as I keep emphasising every time, and I do this because I don't want younger brothers and sisters to think that Bible study requires a knowledge of Hebrew or Greek. You can get a hold of Jusenius, a dictionary, you look it up and you discover, particularly those who are computer literate, it's so easy to do, you just press the word on the computer and you look up and you discover that it has a number in Strong's Concordance of 8351. That's the word that Dr. Strong gave, the number that he gave to that word. And you discover that the real understanding and meaning of that word is not Seth, meaning virtually all mankind almost, but it is a word, and I don't understand what the Hebrew word means, but it comes from a root to do with tumultuousness. And it is a phrase used in Numbers 24, the sons of the tumult of war, or the tumultuous enemies of Israel, a phrase that's picked up in Jeremiah. So, when Christ comes, he's going to destroy all the tumultuous enemies of Israel. Well, now go back and let's ram the point home by saying there are three times over we are told this is a parable. Verse 14. It's a parable about the latter days. Verse 15, a parable. Verse 20. And here's the parable. When Balaam looks on Amalek, he took up this parable and he said, Amalek was the first of nations, and but his latter end shall he perish forever. Well, now this is a prophecy concerning Amalek. Who was Amalek, by the way? Well, the Amalekites were the first major enemy of Israel as they left Egypt. They were the primary enemy of the people of Israel. Historical fact. And so the prophecy is that there is going to come a king who would destroy the Amalekites. And so we turn over to 1 Samuel 15 and we read how Saul says to Samuel, Look, Samuel, I've done what the Lord commanded, and have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of the Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. So that prophecy was fulfilled. Saul says to Samuel, Look, I went out, I did what I was told, I destroyed Agag. Who was Agag? King of the Amalekites. Who are the Amalekites? The primary ancient, consistently tumultuous enemy of Israel. Well, where's the parable? Verse 23, he took up this parable and said, Alas, who shall live when God doeth this? And ships shall come from the coast of Chittim and shall afflict Asher and afflict Eber, and he shall perish forever. Now, these are the two verses that have puzzled me.
Christopher Elkins have long since seen a role for Amalek in the last days in a parabolic form. And so we say this is Balaam's prophetic parable. Makes an interesting subject for a Bible class, incidentally, of how parables are prophetic and how much prophecy can also be seen as a parable too. Well, Balaam's prophetic parable concerned Amalek and Israel in the short term, time of Samuel and Saul and Agag. But in the longer term, the parable, verse 7, tells when Israel will overcome Agag. Well, who was Agag? Agag was the king of the Amalekites. Who were the Amalekites? The number one enemy of Israel will eventually be overcome by a king of Israel. Well, they were. It's important, brothers and sisters, to make a point that the Amalekites have gone. They are finished. So too is Babylon. Babylon has gone and is finished. And there's no way Saddam Hussein, as contemporary evangelicals would say, a latter-day Babylon. Babylon is finished, but it exists, Revelation 17, as the power of Babylon the Great, the Roman Catholic power. And while we're at it, the same applies to Edom. Edom, anyone who's been to Petra knows, Edom is finished. And yet it's around in the last days. Well, it can't be, because it's finished. So what does Edom stand for in the last days? The Arabs? No, that's not a good enough definition. How can it be if it's been destroyed? Any more than Babylon, which has also been destroyed, and the Amalekites. So we're talking here of a parable. Well, these events then were a prophetic parable of the latter days, says so. Now, Agag, if you look in the Septuagint, now you'd be frightened about Septuagint, I just couldn't get it in my case. You turn to it like you turn to an NIV, RSV, or what have you. You look up what the Septuagint says, and you discover that Agag is the same word as Gog. Gog is to be the number one enemy of Israel in the latter days, according to the parable. And so, where does that leave the Amalekites? Well, rather in the same position as the Edomites and the Babylonians of the last day. They're a figure of a type or a power. The Amalekites are a parable or a type of Russia. And so the parable indicates what Agag, that is Gog, will do in the latter days before he too, conforming to the parable and the type, is defeated by another king of Israel, Christ. Well, thus far, no discussion. I think Christadelphians have always seen that parable. But let's look carefully at Numbers 24 and ask ourselves, you ask yourself, what do you make, please, of verses 23 and 24? And he took up his parable and said, alas, who shall live when God doeth this? Doeth what? And ships shall come from the coast of Chittim and shall afflict Asher and shall afflict Eber, and he shall perish forever. What's that got to do with the Amalekites? NIV, then he uttered this oracle. Ah, he says, who can live when God doeth this? For ships will come, or troops will come, from the shores of Chittim, and they will subdue Asher and Eber, but they too will come to ruin. Septuagint says, he looks upon Gog, he took up this parable and said, who can live when El, that's the word for God, doeth this? And we're left with an enigmatic phrase, doeth what? And this is the bit that's often skipped over. So I decided to, again, and I just want to say to younger brothers and sisters, most of whom will have been computer literate, you know, my grandson's only 7, and he goes to school, primary school, and he's fooling around with a computer every day. Well, our teenage brothers and sisters and younger brothers and sisters, when they get to university and college, are fully computer literate. Well, all you have to do is get yourself the right piece of software, and you ask yourself the question, put it up on the screen, press the buttons and say, I wonder what doeth this really means. And so when you do it, and it really is as simple as this, who shall live when God, and you will see the word for God is El, who shall live when God doeth this? What does the word doeth mean? Well, you press the buttons and out comes Strong's Concordance, which says the word number 7760 means appoints or ordains it. So who shall live when El appoints it? Appoints who? Well, appoints Amalek. Who is Amalek? Amalek is the primary enemy of Israel What is Amalek? Why, it's a type of Russia. Who was the leader of Amalek? Agag. What's the parable? Same word.
Go.
So, ships or troops shall come from the side of Cyprus, and they shall proceed to fight Asher and Eber. But his latter day and end shall he perish forever. Any problems with Eber and Asher? Well, probably not with Asher, but we ought to have a look at Eber, because we probably jump to the conclusion, so Eber sounds a bit like Hebrews, must be Jews. Wonder if it is. So all you do is just press the buttons again, and you say, oh, we turn out Jesenius, which is just a simple dictionary, again, lots of Hebrew, don't understand it, but can read English, and you discover that the word for Eber, 5676, means situated across a stream. The region situated across the Arnon. And another word related to it, the region beyond, Chaldean. The region beyond the Euphrates. And all I've done here is photograph a copy out of Jesenius to show you it's, well, it's usable by anybody. But it doesn't solve the problem. It puzzles you. Eber, across a stream. So we just work through it systematically. Who is Eber? Well, you discover it occurs on 15 occasions, three times translated as Eber, twice as Heber. Strong says it means the region beyond, or across the river. Across what? Well, it means across the Jordan looking east, but if you're in Chaldea, across the Euphrates looking west. It means on that side of the river. That's what it seems to me. And you say, well, what's a Hebrew? Well, you look up the word Hebrew again, and here I'm trying to make it as simple as I can. Anybody who has a computer and uses the software for sensible things can press the number Hebrew or the letter Hebrew, and you discover, Strong says, well, that's a word that has a number, and it means one from the far side of the Euphrates. Oh. And the Septuagint has a little footnote. Sorry, I missed a point. You say, well, sorry, wasn't Abraham a Hebrew? Yes, he was, actually. Genesis 14:13 tells you that Abraham was a Hebrew. What's a Hebrew? A Hebrew is one who comes from the far side of the Euphrates. The Septuagint adds a note, one who passes over. Where did Abraham come from, brothers and sisters? The Chaldees. Where is the Chaldees? On the Euphrates. So Abraham did come from beyond the Euphrates. He did cross over the river. He was, in a manner of speaking, baptized. Just like the children of Israel were when they came through the Red Sea, the like figure whereunto baptism does now save us. Interesting, isn't it? That Abraham was baptized, in a manner of speaking. Eber, however, was not just the father of the Jews, but also of Joktan, whose descendants are some of the Arabs in the region beyond the river. Go back to Genesis 10, and you discover that Eber begat Peleg, who begat Abraham, who begat the Jews, known sometimes by us as the Hebrews. But Eber also begat Joktan. Verses 26-29, certain of the Arab nations that if we had time we would point out are more associated with Saudi Arabia. But we now have to go back and answer that question. Who will survive when God doeth this? Doeth what? Who will survive when the God-appointed time comes for Russia, the latter-day Amalekites, under their leader Go, in the parable Agag, who will survive when God appoints Go to move down onto Cyprus en route to its own destruction after attacking, historically, the tumultuous enemies of Israel? Asher and Eber, Assyria and Babylon. We would say today, well, we've got to be very careful we don't limit our thinking to national boundaries, which were just a bit of a carve-up after the First World War. But they will move down onto what we would call Iraq or northeast Syria today. Where are Asher and Eber? Well, we're familiar with where the Euphrates was. We've seen that in other connections this afternoon. So, says Balak, who will survive when God appoints Gog to come down to Cyprus en route to Asher and Eber? There, in the course of that manoeuvre, to meet his destruction. And that's not to say, of course, as Ezekiel points out, that Asher or the northern host will not, of course, also descend into Egypt. But this is a little detail which supplements what we know. Now,
all right,
is that the end of the story? I think not, because I have a question for you. When the great northern confederacy moves southwards through Turkey to Cyprus, what will be waiting for it? You clear? You want a clue? Go to Genesis 10, verse 4. When Agag moves down through Turkey, as we saw before the break, will happen. He will go, yes, to Egypt, that's true, but he'll come to Cyprus. What's waiting for him? The contents of Genesis 10, verse 4. And what do we read? There was Javan, five times translated Greece. He was the father of Elishah, if you identify as the Hellenic Islands. Dodenin, if anyone's been to Rhodes for their holidays, or the Dodecanese Islands, you know that is the same word which you'll find. In fact, some parts of Greece today and Rhodes will refer to Rhodanim as the original name. Very similar, isn't it, to Dodenin? But Kittim also was a son of Javan. You see who his brother is? Tarshish. Interesting. I don't want to break off and be too irrelevant, but just the thought occurred to me when I discovered that. Anyone who knows Cyprus, the name Cyprus comes from Cyprus. It's the copper island. If you go to the northern part of Cyprus, you will know that there they have some of the most gigantic copper mines in that part of the world. So Cyprus is really only a corruption of the word Cyprus. It's the copper island. Britain, alias Tarshish, is the Tin Island. Now, I'm no metallurgist, but I was just playing around with these ideas, and thought came to me that tin and copper, the process of making brass, and it just so happens, isn't it, that brass is a symbol of Greece or Javan. That, of course, is by the way, but let's come back to the point. When Agag Gog comes down onto Cyprus, what's waiting for him? Akrotiri and Decalia. Sovereign territory of Britain, as much part of Britain as Northampton, and there we have the two biggest overseas bases of the power of Tarshish. There's Kittim, there's Decalia. And as anyone knows who goes, you land at Paphos Airport if you're heading for Limassol, and you cut right through a rather strange looking part of Cyprus. And it looks just like a housing estate in Kent or Stafford or Northampton. It's very, very British. And waiting, therefore, for the power out of the north are the forward bases, the largest overseas, 5,000 men, 2,500 civilian population employed at those bases, vital to the war in the Gulf War and to the recent skirmishes in Iran. And you say, well, I'm not really interested in all those military bases. I like to get up into the Troodos Mountains. Anyone been to the Troodos Mountains? You drive up that road that goes round and round and round, and I won't give up on a road like that till I get to the top. And when you get to the top, what do you find, brothers and sisters? The two biggest, most important listening posts of the Western Alliance. And what are they listening to? What are they listening out for? They're listening out for the signs and the messages that will tell them of developments in Russia and elsewhere. So in Cyprus, you have the advanced base of Tarshish, the largest overseas base of Tarshish, which this British government has no intention of relinquishing because they are sovereign territory. So then if we use a more up-to-date map, what are we looking at? we're looking at Cyprus, absolutely vital to British interests in the Middle East, very, very useful for attacking Baghdad and Iraq. And when Gog comes down from the north, he will come to Cyprus. There he will encounter Tarshish before he goes on to the land of Abraham, Ur of the Chaldees, on the other side of the river. And of course, Iran will be the Parthian kings, incidentally, the Iranians will be only too pleased to join in, won't they, and settle their odds with Iraq. So what do we see going on? Anyone who gets the right sort of papers can see that the Turks are today rattling their Aegean sabre. War alert in Turkey and Greece. Turkey is ready to raise the state. It's got its own political reasons for doing so, not the least because it's peeved with the behaviour of Europe. And so there is a struggle coming between Turkey and Greece, and really between North Cyprus and South Cyprus, or between Turkey and South Cyprus. And that is a very real threat. My wife and I just love going to the Greek islands for our holidays, peaceful and quiet, get a lot of reading done. And we went into the airport, bought an English language newspaper when we were there just 18 months ago. And that's the Hellenic Times. That is how the English language newspaper in the Greek island Naxos sees what's going on. They call it a Pax Ottomania. The idea of the Ottoman idea of peace is to fly jets over southern Cyprus, to frighten southern Cyprus into submission. So what is southern Cyprus going to do? I said, well, we're not going to have this. Incidentally, we went to the same island 2 years running. The second year we went back, beautiful little village where we went to has had the most colossal helicopter port built in the last 18 months. And every day you would hear the jets go over. We don't hear much about this. I mean, this country, America's preoccupied with Clinton. This country's more preoccupied, it seems, with Glenn Hoddle and the football world and cricket. And you don't hear these things, brothers and sisters, but if you read the European newspaper, what is Cyprus doing? Moscow's missile meddling raises the spectre of war. This isn't just Philadelphian interpretation of prophecy. These are people saying, look, because of the background, Cyprus is now going to arm itself with missiles. Well, where's he going to get the missiles from? Oh, Russia. Russia want the cash, got the missiles, quite prepared to do a trade. Now that was a year ago. Well, you may say, well, that's old hat. Okay, we were on holiday in Crete, interestingly enough, last autumn. Picked up at the airport, English language newspapers, as my wont is, Athens News, Hellenic Times. What's the main article on the main news page? Is there a threat of Greece and Turkey going to war? Is there a threat of war between Greece and Turkey over the missile issue? The answer is yes. The threat of war is so strong that it has become more and more apparent every day. There's going to be a squabble between those two people over Cyprus. And so I think we can say, yes, the papers are right. The key for the situation is Cyprus. Cyprus wants to join the Christian European Union. Islamic Turkey has been cold-shouldered by the European Union. So Turkey threatens Greece. Over what? The government of Cyprus. About airspace in the Aegean Sea, wherein there is oil. Cyprus is only too well aware of what happened when Turkey marched into Cyprus and invaded it in 1974. And so Cyprus applies to Russia for missiles, self-defense. Russia's only too willing to do a deal. Turkey, however, says, oh no, you can do that deal, but we won't let them go past the Bosphorus. Oh yes you will, says Cyprus and Greece. Oh no we won't, says Turkey. So last autumn, we were reaching a situation where there was going to be an impasse, where even Greek newspapers could see that war was a distinct possibility. Has it been averted? We're not talking about last year, brothers and sisters. Talk about this month. I'm indebted to Donald Pierce, who's been to Cyprus more recently than I have, for bringing back and getting in touch with the Bank of Cyprus, who send a news item on December the 30th, which Donald quickly passes on to me, saying the missiles will now be deployed in Crete. So crisis averted. Next day, Donald only realised this, Turks reject the Cyprus plan for a missile site in Crete, where brother, you know, Zeus or Dad had his place. Interesting, when you see the way the minds work. Well, has the problem been averted? The very next day, brothers and sisters, when you think it's all over, you read in the small print how Turkey was very angry because Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the Kurdish rebels, who Turkish government want to lay hands on him, they want to get hold of that man, he escaped and went to Italy, do you remember? And you discover that Abdullah Öcalan has now quit Italy. He left Campuchino Airport in Rome. He's gone to Russia. Ooh, you can imagine how the Turks are going to be furious with Russia. Brothers and sisters, does it matter whether it's missile, whether it's Cyprus, whether it's Öcalan, or what? We can see that Turkey stands in the way of the Russian advance into the Middle East. What it is that will cause that spark, we know not. But what we can say is, the parable of Balaam concerning Agag in the latter days. Who will survive, brothers and sisters, when the God-appointed time comes for the Russian Amalekites, led by Gog, the latter-day Agag, moved down towards Turkey? For then Gog, that is Agag, will proceed to Cyprus, using it as his springboard to enter the greater Iraq area, the land of Assyria, the land of Babylon, the land of the tumultuous enemies of ancient times, before meeting his doom at Jerusalem, alongside all the other noisy, tumultuous primary enemies of Israel. And who will they be in the last days? Why, the Russian host. And at that time, Christ will save his people from Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted above that of the latter-day Amalekite. No wonder then Balaam asked the question, who will survive those days? To which the answer must be, not many. But may it be through the grace and the mercy of the Lord Christ, Lord Jesus himself, when he returns to the earth, that we may survive those days.
On your behalf, brothers and sisters, I'd like to thank Brother John for a very interesting and enlightening afternoon and evening, and I'm sure that he's